Now, later this month, the 30th anniversary of one of the biggest TV events in the world takes place. That's Live Aid, is what I'm talking about. And for those who are too young to remember, it was a massive global gig held in two cities, televised across the world, watched by almost 2 billion people. It was organised by Bob Geldof and Midge to raise money for famine relief in Ethiopia. And here's just a little reminder.
It's 12 noon in London, 7 a.m. in Philadelphia. And around the world, it's time for Live Aid. Wembley welcomes their Royal Highnesses, the Prince and Princess of Wales.
Sweeney's been looking back at how it all happened. He's here now, and he probably wasn't there then.
I wasn't there physically, no, Dave, but I was watching.
Even in the whole world. Oh, you were alive,
were
you?
I was watching it. Fond memories of it.
Let's just go through it. There's so many different angles you could take with this, but let's start at the beginning. Tell me about the beginning.
Well, very quickly, I mean, October 1984, Michael Burke's famous BBC News report, Bob Geldof saw it. Bob Geldof was moved. The whole world was moved. Bob Geldof decided to do something. He rang Paula Yates, his other half, who was shooting The Tube up in Newcastle, and she had made your next
one. The Tube is a TV programme with herself and Jules Holland that was on at tea time every Friday. If they don't know Live Aid, they're not going to know The Tube.
You fill in the footnotes, Dave. So Midge, who was in Ultravox with a big hit with Vienna, so he was there, so he kind of did a little bit of a melody. He sent it into Geldof. Geldof went visiting someone and wrote the words, or the opening lines, Christmas time, there's no time to be afraid, or it's not time to be afraid, in the back of a taxi, famously. He bumped into people like Gary Kemp when he's walking down the street of Spandau Ballet, famous band in the 80s, in a charity shop. He rang various people. Everyone was on board. They did Band-Aid, they did the record. It went number one. They turned it around in about 2 days. It was number one for about 5 weeks. It raised more money than any record had ever raised for charity. It kind of started to change the world. The next idea then was, why not have a gig? Famously, I think Culture Club, of course, Boy George was the second voice on the Band-Aid record. They had their phenomenal year of 1984. They finished up in London. A whole bunch of people, it was Christmas, turned up. They decided they'd do an encore. What would they do as an encore? Do they know it was Christmas? Geldof was there. The idea of a gig was mooted. Geldof shoots off to Africa then, of course, to see how the money's being spent. Comes back with a shopping list and realises what's needed. They start the Band-Aid Trust, just formed as a charity. Very, very capable people come on board to distribute the money and make sure everything's been done right. It's not going to governments, it's not been siphoned off, and people aren't getting their fingers burned. But Bob Geldof famously said, whenever he was accused of perhaps naivety in getting his fingers burned in Africa, he said, no one has ever tried to do anything in Africa in terms of aid relief without getting their fingers burned, but at least they're doing something. And they chartered boats and all that sort of stuff. So they needed more money, Dave. So why not have a big flipping gig? So it was decided in July the 13th, 1985, originally meant to be July 6th, apparently, that they'd have a gig. They'd have it in two cities. London, obviously. It was originally meant to be New York, apparently. Ended up being Philadelphia. You were here, I assume. Were you here? Were you there doing it yourself?
Oh, damn. I was hoping you wouldn't ask that, because I was just going to say, well, thank you very much for dropping in. I'm saying good luck. That's the full story. I was actually in this very studio, I think. Yeah, we were kind of putting it on here in 2FM wise.
So it was on every radio station, it was on every TV, and that was a great thing. And Gillian Jones, who edited GQ, actually wrote a book that, you know, called The 80s, but he used that day, the 13th of July 1985, as kind of the apotheosis of pop, the apotheosis of popular culture, mainstream culture. And that's the thing about Live Aid. As Geldof says, a great quote, I'm trying to get out somewhere here in a second, but he said, you know, if it's a choice of having, it was in relation to, obviously, one of the main criticisms was the lack of kind of black acts on the bill, as came to pass. He said, if it's a choice between having Steel Pulse and Wham, I'll take Wham any day. The idea was to get everybody involved, to have the biggest, most chart-friendly pop acts in the world on TV for those 10 hours as it was in London, and then the extra 6 hours, I think, it overlapped in the United States.
And of course, one of those would be like anybody even in the middle of their 15 minutes, like Howard Jones. Who? Who since then? But like, you know, he's right now, he's in the charts.
He was Mr. Bankable, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can go through the whole list, but it's phenomenal. What I love, though, is you have, the great thing was, and there's another great quote of Geldof's here, which is kind of, he had one eye, and you know him quite well, I imagine. He had one eye, obviously, on the bankability of all this, because he wanted people watching, and if he got people watching, he could get them donating money.
Yeah.
And you heard there in the intro, as Richard Skinner was the DJ there for the BBC. It's, you know, 12 noon in London, 7 a.m. in Philadelphia. So immediately is this global jukebox idea, this idea that we're all in it together, even in America, they could be watching at 7 o'clock in the morning. But the important thing for him was the imprimatur of the royal family. He got Charles and Diana, and forget Charles, he got Diana. As soon as he got Diana sitting down, and she took her seat famously at that moment,
yeah,
and you see photographs with David Bowie in his lovely suit, with Brian May, and I think Freddie Mercury from Queen, or Roger Taylor in the royal box. So you had that, and she was mixing with the kind of the pop stars at the time. And as he said, as if you get her, you've tuned in a whole section of American society. And that was the key to him. And so they had the royal salute. But then who did they start the gig with?
It was Status Quo, if I remember correctly.
Absolutely. And who better? Do you know why? Because they'd never be, they wouldn't be fazed. They wouldn't be nervous. Yeah. You know, you get a pop back that might be kind of Shrinking Violets. But Status
Quo, they could play Rockin' All Over the World.
Absolutely.
Am I going to play a bit of that
I think
now?
You should, Dave. I was setting up for you there. You just log it in.
Hold on. There's so many things in bits and pieces. As you said yourself, okay, the give us your money thing, or Bob Geldof, the kind of person he was. I've got to play you this, but it's just important. Look, hold on.
The other thing is that Mick and David did that video specifically so that you could give something, and it's not happening enough. You know, you've got to get on the phone and take the money out of your pocket. Don't go to the pub tonight. Please stay in and give us the money. There are people dying now, so give me the money. And here's the numbers.
Let's read them out. We're probably going to get the address first, aren't we?
No, let's pop the address. Let's get the numbers. Because that's how we're
going to
get it.
There was a bit of a controversy about that one there, wasn't there?
There was. Because at the end of the day, that was just after famously Bowie and Jagger. They were meant to do kind of a synchronized thing from either side. It was never going to work with the technology. Anyway, I don't think it worked today. Oh, but they did Dancing on the Street. They played the video, and it's one of the famously bad cover versions of all time. But everyone bought it because it was for charity. But people weren't donating. They weren't donating. They weren't ringing in. And your man there as the BBC is kind of going, I'll give you the address. And Bob goes, F the address. And you know, give us your money. Give us your money. And it's one of the most famous pieces of television of all time. Yeah. And what happened was all, you know, after he did that, people, he communicated the passion and people started ringing in. And famously, of course, there is footage of Bob on one documentary or other backstage kind of being all kind of emotional or swelling with pride, because who are the highest donors per capita? The Irish.
Irish people.
Of course. Because we're great crack. Did you find Status Quo?
No, hold on. Okay, if you want Status Quo, then I'll give you the damn thing. Here it goes.
And now, to start the 16 hours of Live Aid, would you welcome Status Quo?
What better way to start?
And I like it. Okay, again, like I could ask you a million questions.
Well, can I give you some factoids?
Give me some factoids.
This is a great little thing that I didn't realise up until a couple of years ago, because you certainly don't notice these things at the time. But helicopters were big, of course. How are they going to get all these superstars in and out of Wembley? And they're in for like their 15-minute or the 20-minute slot, and some of them stayed around all day, some of them didn't. So famously, there was a cricket pitch near Wembley. So and Noel Edmonds was one of these helicopter pilots, by the way, but we'll park that for a second. So what they did was, there was this cricket pitch, and not only was the team out playing cricket during the day, every time they saw the helicopter arrive with, I don't know, Bowie or Elton John or George Michael or Spandau Ballet with inside it, they'd have to pick up the bales, they'd all march off in their whites, and the helicopter would land, and then they'd go back out and resume the match. And this went on all day, and there was a wedding reception that evening, and the father of the groom got very, very annoyed by this persistent interruption to the speeches and the dancing and the dining and all that sort of stuff by these huge lumbering helicopters arriving and disgorging pop stars on the crease. So David Bowie was dispatched to mollify things, and apparently that worked famously.
I did hear
it's
that story.
It's a great little story. It's a great little backstage story.
Lots of little stories.
They raised £150 million, which is mad in terms of ticket sales. I mean, they're £25 each. They had posters sold.
£25 was enough, wasn't it?
It was a lot. And apparently, now I didn't realise this either until a couple of years ago, again, this is in Dylan Jones's book, that they were accepting walk-ups, but it was huge, and I think they had 90,000 tickets in Philadelphia. So that was that. Who was second on the bill, Dave? Do you remember?
No.
There's a trivia question. It's good. Style Council. Who was the one that famously is said to have lost at Live Aid? Who missed the point? And apparently he was meant to do three songs. Cut two and decided to play his
Bob.
New single. No.
Well, Bob in America certainly lost. He went on about Farm Aid.
Bob Dylan, of course, famously, Yanni broke a string.
And then Ronnie Wood played an air guitar. Yeah.
Adamant, famously, is the man who was said to have missed it. He was meant to have done three songs, I believe. Stand and Deliver and Goody Two Shoes were cut, and he decided to go with Vive La Rock, his new single.
Mistake. You don't do Big that there, anything like this. You play the hits. Look, here he goes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Adamant.
Viva La Rock.
Yeah, who remembers Adamant. That song? Yeah, just me, because I'm a huge Adamant fan. But famously, George Michael did his new single at the closing ceremony of the 2012 London Olympics.
Oh,
and was said
to
have done an Adamant.
Yeah, not a great idea.
No. Now, of course, Bob Geldof performed. He was third or fourth on the bill. Actually, he was third on the bill after the Style Council. And he nailed it with the first song, which is I Don't Like Mondays. And there was, you know, the breakdown, the piano breakdown.
And, he goes,
and the lesson today is
How to Die.
It's brilliant.
And then How to Die goes on for silence.
Yeah.
Thank you.
best day of his life, yeah. Okay, that's the rats at Live Aid. That's what we're talking about now, 30 years next weekend. So tell me more.
It's one of those seminal moments, actually, where, yeah, where the song breaks down there. I suppose from another point of view, another Irish point of view, and one of the features of the event is there are kind of some celebrity people, some celebrities introducing the acts, particularly in America, Chevy Chase, Bette Midler, and this fella, Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson was reportedly at, was it the Roxy or wherever U2 played recently in LA, that club gig? And someone mentioned Jack Nicholson. I was like, why was Jack Nicholson there? And immediately my brain went back to this moment when he introduced them from Philadelphia and they were playing in London. Yeah. And it was one of those moments. U2 were on probably second in terms of the ones who triumphed most at Live Aid. Queen, obviously, the ones who won it effectively.
Okay, let's take a blast.
This is Jack.
The great Jack.
I don't know just how it works, but now we're going to hook up with the electronic portion from Wembley. Want to thank Brian Adams. And now, to keep with the international and global feeling that we have, a group... What? Direct from London, Bill tells me, a group whose heart is in Dublin, Ireland, whose spirit is with the world, a group that's never had any problems saying how they feel, you too.
Someday, buddy, someday.
And they did their thing. Another band who was meant to have three songs, but they didn't play three songs.
They didn't indeed. The story of that one goes on for volumes, all right, just in terms of how they did bad live and thought they blew it all, went back into the dressing room and all hit each other and said, my God, we made a total fool of ourselves, and they hadn't.
They absolutely hadn't. But Bono was trying to rescue that girl from the crowd because she was getting crushed, apparently. Three girls, in fact. There was one down the front and then two halfway up.
Yeah, and they had a bunch of albums out before that. Every single one of them went into the top 10.
That's
after
absolutely true. Queen are the one band who went and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and did it. And they had a lot of kind of, I suppose, ground to claw back. They weren't cool anymore, if they were ever cool, but also they'd been to Sun City and stuff, and politically they were a bit dodgy and a little bit toxic, with good reason, by the way. And so they did their greatest hit set, but before that, Smith & Jones, the late Mel Smith, and of course Griff Rhys-Jones, people will know from Darragh Breen's Three Men and a Boat and stuff like that, came out dressed as policemen and did their little introduction bit.
1, 2, 1, 2.
Yeah, I know what follows 2, Constable, thank you very much.
This is our spare lead vocal, Mike.
Constable,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have had a bit of a complaint about the noise. From a woman in Belgium.
Anyway, it gives us enormous pleasure to introduce the next combo, who are...
And would it be fair to say, with Smith and Jones there, as in Alias, that the next band that came out really were the ones who benefited most in terms of just the band profile?
Absolutely. They
Queen.
Rocked. They had 15 minutes. They filled every second of that. Even Freddie got to do a da-da-da-da-da sing-along bit in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
They did Hammer to Fall, a recent enough song. They did Bohemian Rhapsody, Radio Gaga, Hammer to Fall, Crazy Little Thing Called Love, We Will Rock You When We Are the Champions. How could you fail by ending We Will Rock You When We Are the Champions? Well, they did little bits of it, you know what I mean? They didn't do all of Bohemian Rhapsody, yeah, but they kind of, they did enough. They did all the populist bits, that all the bits that people could sing along. And also, the time they came on stage, I don't know the actual time they came on stage here, do I? I do. They came on stage about 20 to 7. So, you know, that's nearly 7 hours into the gig, and people have been there in the sunshine all day. Yeah. That sort of lift in terms of scheduling, they were on a perfect time as well. And it was the communion of band and
just
crowd.
Just a matter of interest. Okay, we're talking about those who were there. Who turned it down?
This is interesting, actually. Dave Stewart said no on behalf of the Eurythmics. Apparently, he just didn't want to know, says Midge. I wonder if he regrets that now. I'd say he did. Liza Minnelli, Yoko Ono, Cyndi Lauper, Billy Joel, Kris Kristofferson, all featured in a US promo material, but didn't turn up. Paul Simon and Huey Lewis both had fights with Bill Graham, who was promoting in the US. So
actually,
I believe I read a book
about Bill Graham, as in not the Irish journalist now, but the American promoter, and a lot of people had a lot of disagreements with him.
Yeah, so I don't think that's unusual in the biz. Rod Stewart was on tour, David Byrne Lennon was finishing the Two Stories film, AC/DC turned it down. Def Leppard, of course, Rick Allen's accent, the drummer there, had to pull out. Frank Zappa had a great quote, and you know, there are a lot of cynics around, a lot of cynical quotes about Live Aid and Band Aid indeed. He called it the biggest cocaine money laundering scheme of all time. Tears for Fears, this is interesting actually, because it kind of circular. Tears for Fears had 5 days off. Bob begged them to turn up. They were huge, of course, at the time. They were huge in America, let's not forget, with Shout and Everybody Wants to Rule the World.
Right.
They didn't. Bob said they were playing. They got annoyed and went off on holiday or something, but they felt bad and they, of course, donated Everybody Wants to Rule the World, which became Everybody Wants to Run the World for Sport Aid a year later.
Yeah.
Culture Club, while Boy George was having his problems with drugs and didn't want to do it. Famously, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Dave, who couldn't have been any bigger in 1984-85, turned it down. Only Holly Johnson wanted to do it, and that kind of torpedoed their career, you could argue. And Bruce Springsteen, of course, didn't realise how big it was going to be, but left stage and rigging gear behind, so they used that in Wembley, but he regrets it since.
Okay, I've 8 seconds of Duran Duran here.
Yes, yes. I was too young, so I kind of was in bed when this happened, although obviously I was a huge Duran Duran fan.
You were having a nap.
I was, well, I was sent to bed, I'll tell you. Simon Le Bon, this is the lowest moment of his career, the most embarrassing moment of his career, I think, was the quote. This is the bum note heard around the world. When Freddie Mercury kind of nailed, I think, one of the sing-along things he would sustain and stuff, that was the note heard around the world. That was the bit everyone's kind of, whoa. This is the other end of things. In the middle of the night in the UK, he's singing A View to a Kill, not the greatest song. He's not the greatest singer in the world. And, well, look, it's just listen to it. It's terrible.
Okay. Poor old Simon. Hold on, I won't last. Could you get up in front of all those?
No, that's me at every New Year's Eve party ever. But of course, famously Led Zeppelin, of course, sort of reformed, but didn't call themselves Zeppelin. It was Page, Plant, and Jones, wasn't it? And Phil Collins drumming for them. Their stuff was so under rehearsed, and Jimmy Page pulled it. And now he donated money since to the Band Aid Trust or Live Aid Trust. Whatever.
So there is an English writer whose name I'm suddenly remembering. Danny Baker, one of these people, have written about the fact that the celebrity culture that we now know today and didn't know in the past, say, was born that day.
Mm.
Just in terms of, like, if Annie Lennox said anything, we'd all go, what's Danny saying? Mm. Like, who gives a damn about Lennox?
No, absolutely. And but of course, the pop and politics, that was the ultimate kind of mixing of both. And it did change pop culture for the better or for the worse, but I think for the better. Certainly in terms of gigs like this, in terms of fundraising, we had our own self-aid a year later.
Yeah.
It became not an industry, but it became something that was acceptable and something that was known and something that was achievable.
Yeah.
And certainly,
by the way, can I just ask, Cat Stevens, was he involved somewhere along the way or not?
There's a great story that he was, he of course had gone into hiding, basically seclusion, and there is a story that apparently is true, that he turned up with his guitar to Wembley, but no one had a slot available for him. He could have been the first time we've been seen in, I don't know, the guts of 10 years apparently in public, which is a great story. There's another great one, because Phil Collins, of course, did London and then Philadelphia, and he went via Concord, and just, you're talking about celeb culture, Noel Edmonds, TV presenter extraordinaire, was the guy who flew the helicopter from Wembley to Heathrow, and then he got on to Concord, and there was a link up on BBC with him on Concord. It was all like this stuff that was like the future. But he bumped into Cher on the plane, and Cher had no idea about Live Aid, and he was telling her all about this. You can imagine them hobnobbing in first class. And next thing, he goes and he plays with Eric Clapton, plays with whoever, goes back to his hotel room because he's knackered, watches the finale of the Philadelphia gig in his hotel room television, and who's there on stage? Only Cher. She just turned up.
Great, I love it.
I kind of love Cher, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah. I like that. That's pretty good.
So that apparently, well, it did happen because you can see her there. So, and why would Phil Collins lie, ladies and gentlemen? Why would he lie?
Exactly.
The only major hiccup, unfortunately, was during the now Sir Paul McCartney's finale during Let It Be, and no one in the stadium could hear him because his mic failed, but you could hear it on TV just about because the other mics on stage picked him up.
Paul McCartney, let's go back to Bob.
He only did it because his kids told him to.
Who?
Paul,
yeah. Okay.
And I think interesting, Bob wanted him because it was the imprimatur again of the pop establishment.
Oh, yeah.
And The Who, of course, famously reformed as well. So, although they'd only been broken up for 3 years. Yes, Bob Geldof, I mean, at the end of the day, because you watched the Bob concert, because you gave money, because you raised cash for a very worthy cause, something that was close to his heart, you know, he did change people's lives.
You can be absolutely sure that on the day you die, there'll be somebody alive in Africa because one day you bought a record or a book or watched a pop concert. And that at one is a compliment and a triumph, and on the other hand, it's the ultimate indictment of us all. There must be better systems.
Indeed, that's Bob.
I should just point out, actually, there was only one female act, solo act, in the entire bill, the entire 10 hours in the United Kingdom. And do you know who that was? Sade. It was Sade. And do you know who she lived next door to? This is my favourite pop fact.
Lived next door to in real life?
Yes.
In real life?
In Highbury in London.
As opposed to on the stage.
Sade lived next door to Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet.
Really? These are things I need to know.
They are. Sade was the only female act.
Madonna.
On her own.
Oh, she was
in London. Famously, Madonna was at London, and she said she wasn't going to take anything off today because it was really, really hot. But of course, the Playboy pictures had come out. And Madonna was introduced then. She played with Nile Rodgers and Steve Stevens and the Thompson Twins. And there's a great bit, if you do watch this on YouTube, very funny. It kind of goes, blah, blah, blah. It's Nile Rodgers. It's Steve Stevens, you know, the rock guitar player. And he goes, oh, yeah. And where's he? Here's Madonna. Just like, that was 1985, people. He wouldn't have been doing it in 1987, let me tell you.
No, damn right. Well, in fact, the funny thing about that is, that here's one for you then that you might know.
Go on.
Who was number one in America at the time, and they played at Live Aid? They were number one with the single and album charts, I think, certainly the singles charts.
A band? Did they play in the American leg?
I think they probably did. No, I can't.
Wasn't the Hooters? No,
it was Simple Minds.
Simple Minds, yes.
Yeah. Don't You Forget About Me.
Which they played.
A song they didn't write themselves, a song that was offered to somebody else who refused it, and that somebody else played in London at Live Aid. Brian Ferry, Things You Need to Know.
I did not know the Brian Ferry bit. That is brilliant. That is a pop fact. Now, just in case anyone's complaining, Alison Moyet did sing half of one of Paul Young's songs. She should have been given her own set. Anyway, and there was...
the Style Council.
Shade, of course, I mean, and she was one of the few black acts as well, it has to be said. But as I said, Bob was going for populist, and look, he's a man who knew his mind. And hey, it made gazillions, so why not?
It did indeed. All right, well, listen, Owen Sweeney, thanks a million for taking us back 30 years to Live Aid summer, right in the dead centre of 1985.
That's right.
In the dead centre of the 1980s. Let's go for the finale.